Hello, and welcome to David's Book Talk. And today we have John Gilstrap with us. He's a New York Times bestselling author, and his newest book is called Damage Control, and it's out from Pinnacle Kensington. That's the name of the publisher. And you can get it for $9.99 paperback, and I assume it's an e-book too, right?
It's in all the e-book formats, yeah.
Right. Times certainly have changed since I've talked to you last. I'm trying to remember the last time. I know it was at Barnes & Noble, but I don't know if I saw you after that. A couple times at Barnes & Noble. That was so many years ago.
It has been a while. You know, they start adding up after a while.
Right. Now, do they call this book I had the term in my head now. I've completely lost. A mass market thriller? Or how do they exactly term these books?
I've not heard that. It's a thriller. Commercial thriller, I guess.
Commercial thriller?
Yeah.
Now, you're writing a series now. You didn't used to write series when you started.
And no, my first four novels were standalone thrillers, and then my fifth book was actually a nonfiction book that introduced me to Special Forces community, and in fact, that was the only book that Delta Forces ever cooperated in. And then after that, I sort of got the idea of this freelance hostage rescue character that's kind of gained some traction. And so Jonathan Grave is now my series character.
He's a very interesting man. I mean, and I like the fact that he has a sense of humor, and with his partner. I mean, amidst all this violence and killing, you know, he's got this sense of humor about him.
Well, I think that's true of all of those kinds of guys, whether they're soldiers or I spent 15 years in the fire service, cops. There's an acceptance of the foibles of life that it's a source of humor among these folks, as well as their job to bring order to chaos.
Now, when you were writing your standalone, Nathan's Run, which I think is, oh, man, I love that book, Nathan's
Run. Thank you.
I still remember reading that book, how wonderful it was, and just the sense of adventure through the whole book of this kid who's on the run the whole book. It's just one of those books that you never forget.
Thanks.
I think, and that's a sign of a good writer when they have a book like that. I mean, it's hard to have every book like that. Do you find that true? Why did you decide to do a series all of a sudden? I mean, do you suddenly wake up one morning and say, I'm going to do a series?
Well, no, actually, I got this idea of the Jonathan Grave character, and just by way of background, when American citizens are overseas, and they're kidnapped, they're taken hostage, the American intelligence community starts working right away on their rescue. And more times than not, these rescues are done through the local police agencies of whatever country that they're in. But there are parts of the world where that doesn't work very well. So if the order goes to make the rescue, then it will either be Navy SEALs or the Army's Delta Force. And they go in and they snatch the good guys from the bad guys, and there's a single mission, and that's to rescue the good guy. Whatever happens to the bad guys, you know, if they put their weapons down, they could have a good day. If they don't, then they probably won't. In the United States, when you're kidnapped, it's the FBI hostage rescue team primarily, and local SWAT teams and what have you. But the reality is, since we're a nation of laws, and the reality is that it's much more complicated to do a hostage rescue here than it is overseas, because there's a whole due process thing, which is very valuable. So I got this idea of a character who would take the foreign model, or the overseas model, the Delta Force model, and apply it domestically on a freelance basis. So that's what Jonathan Grave does. Somebody, if your loved one is kidnapped, you hire Jonathan and he brings him back. And in the process, he ends up actually violating local laws, because sometimes the bad guys die. In my books, frequently the bad guys die. And often that's treated as a homicide. But
Jonathan has a conscience, though. It's interesting. He's not just this serious guy who just goes around killing people. He really has a conscience, and he really has a problem sometimes killing people. And I find that interesting. It's not just one of these thrillers where, oh, he's going to kill everybody he sees because he's obsessed with killing people.
No, he's got a huge heart. In fact, he's quite the philanthropist. He's a wealthy fellow.
Just like you, right?
Yeah, right. I wish. So anyway, in writing this, I ended up with this fairly complex character, and I thought, wow, he's got legs. And I decided to, and my publisher agreed that we do it as a series, and so far it kind of keeps chugging along.
Now, is it more difficult to do a series than it is to do standalone books?
You know, it's kind of different. It's like using different parts of your brain. The main characters get to develop much more slowly over a multi-book arc, which means, you know, it's a little like putting on your favorite pair of shoes. You still have the footprint in them when you start a new book. But there's a different challenge, too, and that is that, first of all, if it's the fifth book in the series and it's the first book that a reader picks up, it has to feel fresh and it has to make sense. But at the same time, you don't want to bore the folks who have been with you the whole time.
Now, this is book number...
Being fresh can be a challenge.
Right. So this is book number 4 or 5?
That's book number 4. I'm writing book number 5 right now.
So this is going to be a long series. This is going to be like a Jack Reacher kind of long, like 25-book series.
Oh, you're lifting God's ear. I hope so. That would be lovely.
I mean, it's amazing how... I mean, I don't know how writers do it. And as I'm reading Damage Control, I'm thinking... How does he do this? There's so many details. There's so many characters. You're introducing new characters all the time. The reader's thinking, who is this character, and how do they interact with the other characters? What's going to be the connection here? And that's what makes it interesting. And yet at the same time, you have to keep track of all these characters. Like, now, who is this? Now, this is obviously the bad guy. And, you know, in your mind, you're trying to get them all sorted out. Do you have trouble when you're writing them, keeping them all straight?
No, I don't. But that's outlining. So, you know, I always know what the ending's going to be while I'm writing, and the trick is to not telegraph it to the reader too quickly. But no, I have tried writing thrillers without an outline one time, and it was a nightmare. So it really helps to plot stuff out, and if you lay the plot out in a lengthy outline, I'm talking like, you know, 20, 30 typewritten pages, you just know where the different plot points need to fill in and when you need to introduce the new characters and such. It's a little like moving pieces on a game board.
But you're able to keep them in all straight, all the characters straight, and who, all the backstory and all the characters. That must be hard too. I mean, you have to remember what did they do in the book before. I have to know that all, and you have to remember all that.
That's the hard part. It's to make sure that characters that go from one book to the other, you know, their hair color hasn't changed.
Things like that, you know, simple things like that. Like how they walk or how they talk or how...
Exactly, exactly.
I mean, the way they talk has to be the same through every book. I mean, you can't suddenly change the character because then you get all the readers that write to you and say, oh, you changed that character. I caught you.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the fear. You hate to get caught by a reader.
So you're now doing books that are paperback now instead of hard. You mean, you were doing hardcover to paperback. Now you're doing all paperback. Is there a different way to write those, or how does that work? I mean,
Well, that's fundamentally a decision that's made by the publisher. The thought was this: the first book, No Mercy, came out, I believe, in 2008, which was a very, very bad time economically, and. The thought was, and I think it's proving to be true, that the best way to introduce a new series character is in paperback, where it's more affordable for the reader. People take a chance on something they haven't read before. And it was also kind of a departure from the stuff that I had written previously. So you want to make it as easy for the readers as possible to take a chance, and the easiest way to do that is through paperback.
Now, I found when I first started reading this book, I was a little confused with everything that was going on. I mean, where's this story headed? There's a pretty bloody opening in this book, and it kind of surprised me a little. I didn't know to expect it, and then it kind of levels out, and you start telling the story. So there was a little bit of a confusion in the beginning, and then it got really, really, really interesting. And I find that that's true of a lot of books nowadays. The beginning is a little confusing, but is that because of the way you tell the story? Is that meant to be that way, or?
Well, it's certainly never meant to be confusing. It's meant to startle the reader a little bit.
It definitely startled me. I thought, wow, well, this is like massive.
In the first three books, Jonathan has all the rescue missions go reasonably well, and this one opens with a hostage exchange is supposed to be, in the jungles of Mexico, and it goes horribly awry, and that proves to be a plot point for Jonathan, because there are hostages that die in this, and it's really hard on him. It's also, we introduce a character named Tristan Wagner, who is fairly traumatized by the events that happen around him. He's very traumatized by the events that happen, and you know, I got to get all that out quickly in order for the book to take off quickly. So,
right. But you read the back of the book and you think, oh, this is a book about a hostage situation, but it's not really. It only starts out that way, and I thought, the whole book's going to be about a hostage situation. I had visions of that Jeffrey Deaver book, Maiden's Grave, I guess it was, mm-hmm. that was so wonderful. But then this turns into something else. So I like the fact that it's different than I thought it was going to be. I like the fact that you don't know where it's headed right away, or at least I didn't know. You know, because you're the writer.
Well, I think, you know, as an author of commercial fiction, I feel it's really important to always keep the reader on edge. That every time they think they understand what's about to happen, you smack them around a little bit, and always within the sleeve of reason, you know, the characters would act that way.
You're a very violent writer, you know.
I'm a very peaceful writer. My characters are very violent.
Right. But I mean, you like to write about violence. You like violence. Why is that? I mean, we read books, you know, I think of James Patterson, his books that always tend to be violent, and yours are violent. Is that fun to write?
It's not necessarily fun. I just think if, given the subject matter that I write about, there's always going to be murder involved because it's sort of the nature of the genre. But I was a paramedic for 15 years, and for me, you know, violence is really awful. It smells bad, and it looks terrible, and it hurts people. And, you know, I think that by presenting violence in a way that makes people uncomfortable gets much closer to what the violence really is, as opposed to the dead butler in the library of, you know, the Agatha Christie days where death was a very sterile thing.
Right, exactly.
And it's not. It's death is really anything but sterile.
And that's interesting you bring up that point, because you think of Mary Higgins Clark, whose books are so tame. I mean, the people get killed. Everyone in her book, somebody dies. But it's uh-huh. never a gratuitous violence. She never describes the violence. She never gets above that. So it's different with every author. But, I mean, some authors like to describe them. I look at Stephen King. I mean, you get description of what happens to the body after it's killed, you know, by the monster or whatever it is that's killing the person. But then you have mysteries where people die. And yet it's not what you would consider a violent book.
Well, and those are the various tastes of different readers. You know, you've got the cozies versus the hard-boiled mysteries versus the thrillers versus, you know, the forensic thrillers, serial killers.
Right.
There are levels of violence that I won't go to and that I won't read. You'll never see on-camera violence or on-the-page violence to children, with the exception of Nathan's Run, and even that was the really awful stuff was people think they saw it, but it was never actually on the page.
Now, between this new series, this is book four, you said, and when you were writing this, there was a little gap where you weren't writing.
Actually, that's not true. There was never a gap that I wasn't writing.
Really?
There was a gap where I was doing nonfiction, and fiction readers don't find you.
I didn't even know.
Yeah, that, and therein lies the problem.
Why were you doing that? And what was the?
I was introduced to this story. It's a nonfiction thriller called 6 Minutes to Freedom, about a fellow named Kurt Muse, who ran he was the most wanted man in Panama in the late '80s. He's an American citizen who ran a radio station along with some co-conspirators to bring down Manuel Noriega. And ultimately, he was betrayed and arrested, and the night he was arrested, his daughter and her 15-year-old daughter and her 12-year-old brother had to flee the country by themselves. And so you got all of that story, and then ultimately Kurt was rescued by Delta Force in the opening moments of Operation Just Cause. So it was just this tremendous story that had never been told.
You seem to have a pattern there of books where people are fleeing from something.
Well, it is. That's true. I mean, I would have to say that
I mean, that seems to be your pattern. If somebody had to say, well, what is he generally write about it? Now that it strikes me that you do write about people fleeing. Where does that come from?
I have no idea. You know, if writers look too deeply into their souls, you don't want to do that. It could get ugly pretty quickly.
But as a paramedic, I'm sure you saw a lot of trauma. As well as blood and horrific situations. I think of that series when I was a kid called Emergency, where they go to these.
That's why I became a firefighter.
Because of Emergency?
Yeah, that Johnny Gage, Roy DeSoto thing. I thought that was so cool.
I'll never forget the one episode where somebody had swallowed a soda pop top, and it was stuck in their throat. I mean, it's funny how these little situations just stick in your mind for years and years and years, and you just remember them. You think, oh, that's so horrifying. What would I do if I got something stuck in my throat like that? And it's such a simple thing, but you know that's what life's all about. You know, you're fine one minute, and you couldn't be the next. I mean, something could happen the next moment.
Well, at one level, those were my formative years, the fire department. I mean, 23 years old, you walk into the worst moments of people's lives, and you bring order to chaos. I mean, it really, and sometimes not. You know, it depends on more times than not, you leave with a happy ending, and right. that's just a very, very cool feeling.
It's got to be. I mean, you go home thinking, I really did something that mattered today. I really changed somebody's life for the better.
Yeah.
What a great feeling. Well, what is your background? Were you actually born in Virginia?
I was a Navy brat, so I was born in Florida. We moved around a little bit, but we settled in Virginia when I was 7. Dad had back-to-back tours at the Pentagon and then retired. So
were you writing at 7?
Yes, actually I was.
You were?
Well, not professionally.
What were you writing? I mean, were you...
Always stories, always fiction, always a lot of chase me kinds of stories, actually, even then.
Where is that coming from? I have to know.
I really don't know. I think that's the kind of...
Has anybody pointed that out before?
Yeah. It makes for very compelling fiction, I think, to put people in the heads of innocents who are trying to get away. You know, I come to think it was probably the Alfred Hitchcock influence. You know, I mean, I was devoted to Alfred Hitchcock movies when I was a kid.
And, like North by Northwest.
By Northwest, or The Birds, which in itself is kind of a fleeing movie. Not so much Psycho, but that's always freaked me out. That's the one I really I get uncomfortable watching.
Right. That's what made him so great. You felt uncomfortable while you were watching the movie. You felt like they were really happening. I mean,
right. The Man Who Knew Too Much. Another one. The Jimmy Stewart one.
So maybe that's where it's from. Maybe you could. Alfred Hitchcock is one of the reasons you're writing these books today. Well, how has your writing changed? I mean, in your mind, or has it changed?
How is it? It evolves. I look at, I had occasion, Nathan's Run was just re-released last year.
Oh, I didn't realize that. Oh.
And so I had occasion to read over it and proof it again. And I resisted the urge to actually make substantive changes. There are elements to the plotting of that book that I would do entirely differently now. But I left that go. I took out a lot of the profanity that was in it in the original version.
Oh.
But in reading through the book, each book kind of captures a slice of my life. Not that you would see it as a reader, but I see it as a writer and what was important to me at that time. And all of that evolves over time. I think I've become less cynical in my writing over the years.
Less cynical. And Nathan's Run is such a fantastic book. In fact, I didn't know it was available. I work at a bookstore, and I would definitely have recommended it had I known it was even out.
Re-released as an e-book. It comes out as a paper book next year.
Oh, okay. So it's not actually a book yet. I mean, it's an e-book, but it's not re-released yet, even though they show it in the front cover here of Damage Control. I see it on the left-hand side there. But that's just... Oh, I just love that book.
Thank you.
Do you find that what you write is what you like to read too?
Absolutely.
I mean,
it's so much of what I read is what I write. Yeah. By the time you write it and then edit it.
How do you read other people's work without it influencing your own? Is that hard, or is it easy to put that to the side and just go back to your own?
For me, it's easy, and it's funny. I get that question a lot, and the question itself, all respect, the question itself doesn't resonate with me because I can't conceive of how that would influence. You know what I mean? It's like different. I keep talking about different parts of my brain, but it's I read or I write. I don't think the only thing influence that I would get from somebody else's book, I think, would be a structural thing that they do. You know, if for example, way back in the day, The Day of the Jackal by Frederick Forsyth, which I think is the most perfect thriller ever written, had a huge impact on my writing. In fact, if you look at just the basic structure, the way he uses space breaks and shifting points of view and what have you, if you take a look at how he did, Day of the Jackal, and you look at the structure of my books, you're going to see very close similarity between the two. And that's where I learned pacing.
Now everybody's going to rush out and buy Day of the Jackal to say,
yeah,
let's see how it is.
I'm selling somebody else's book. Like, he needs my help.
Yeah, but then they have to compare it to yours, and they end up buying yours, too. So it's a good
thing. Okay, there you go. And all of them to make sure that the comparison is consistent.
Now, are you selling more e-books than regular books now? Or how? I mean, in your experience with your books, how is that working out for you?
It's about a wash, I think. I certainly sell a lot of e-books. And I sell a reasonable amount of the paper books too. The problem with paperbacks as a format is that the outlets for paperbacks are going away. Bookstores are becoming fewer and fewer, and the magazine racks in the drugstore, you know, where it used to sell, where I bought all of my books as a kid, those have gone away. So
what about the airports?
Airports kind of hit and miss. That's very expensive real estate. In fact, if you look at the paperbacks that are stocked in an airport bookstore, for the most part, it's last year's hardcover bestsellers. There are very few, if any.
Oh, really? That's a shame. I mean, it's so much of an opportunity for people to discover new authors, and I like the way you write. I like reading your books. I'm sitting here just laying in bed this morning reading this book, and it's just so... It's so much fun to read. I mean, just enjoying seeing how the story unfolds. I mean, that's half the fun of reading a book, seeing how that story unfolds. It can't be boring. It's got to be interesting all the way through.
Exactly.
And, you know, once you hit that boring part, you're going to put the book down. So it's a constant threat to the writer. They have to keep this book interesting all the way through. Is that hard to do?
I think it is. Pacing is the challenge of a book. In fact, my wife loves to tell a story that she's always my first reader, and as she's reading the manuscript, just the printed manuscript pages, if she gets up from the book and walks away, I come in to see where she stopped. If she stopped at a chapter break, everything's fine. If she stopped in the middle of a chapter to, you know, whatever reason one stops, I take a really serious look at that section because clearly...
That's interesting.
It was okay to leave at that point, so I give you chapter breaks to go to the bathroom. If you leave in the middle of a chapter, unless the phone rings, I worry that there's something wrong.
There's so many thrillers out there. I mean, that's the problem. There's so many different writers and so many different styles. How do you make yours different from others? How do you make it stand out so people will read it?
Well,
you talked about the pacing, but...
What differentiates my books is the heart. All of my thrillers have a big heart. They've got characters who I like to think that the reader can bond with. The primary character in this case, Jonathan Grave, he's a good guy. I mean, he's a gentle man and a gentleman who's just capable of great violence when he's pushed to it. And Tristan, in this case, the hostage who's being helped out back into the country, also a nice guy. And the bad guys, I like to think, are well-motivated. So right. I think it's the heart of my stories.
All right, let's talk about damage control a bit. Now, I'm wondering, as I'm reading this book, about your research. I mean, do you go to these countries where they take place and get a feel of the country? I mean, what kind of research do you do before you write the book?
I do as kind of an evasive answer, but I do as much research as is necessary.
That's very evasive.
Yeah, but I don't. It's because I'm not an obsessive researcher. Research can be an enormous time suck. As an example, I did not go to Mexico for this book because I didn't think it was necessary. There's the jungle And I've been to jungles before, not the Mexican jungle, but if you look carefully at the book, it's the description of the flora and fauna is all very generic. I did have to go and find out, there's a military vehicle, Mexican military vehicle, that I needed to show up. So I did do some research about what is their version of the Humvee, and it turns out to be a thing called a Sandcat. So I got some pictures of that, I saw what it looked like, I got it, and then, you know, I know it's on a Ford F-150 chassis, and I get just enough to pull it off, and then I move on. Plus, I have a background. My work background dealt a lot with explosives and hazardous materials and that sort of thing. So that I've already got. And then the research I did for 6 Minutes to Freedom gives me a lot of the tactical stuff that I need for Jonathan and Boxes to do their thing. So it's just a matter of, it's not important that I be able to do what they do. It's important for the reader to believe that the characters can do what they can do.
Right. You're a very confident writer. Have you always been that way? I mean, I can hear the confidence in your voice. I mean, you just seem to have a, I know what I'm doing. Not an ego, just a really nice confidence about yourself. Like you're sure about what you're doing.
I like to think I am. I know what my weaknesses. Well, I know what my weaknesses are, and I know to buttress those, and I'm fairly confident on what my strengths are. My strengths lie in character and action. My weaknesses lie in some other areas. I'll let the reviewers find. But I guess I'm reasonably confident. Yeah. I've been doing this for a long time. It's been like 15 years since Nathan's Run came out.
So. Do you ever get tired of writing?
No.
Never. No. You never have a day.
Well, I get tired of writing at about the 220 page mark of every book.
Oh, really?
That's the middle part is
what
so
happens
hard.
On page 220 here.
That's where you've got all of the heavy duty plot development that's going on. That's where the reveals of backstory come out. It's the transitional meaty area from I know how it's going to start. I know what the basic premise is, and I know how it's going to end. I just have to connect those two parts, and that's the hard part for me.
But is it hard to think of all these things, or does it come? I mean, you've done it for 15 years now. Is it becoming easier with each book to figure out all the plot angles and where everything's coming from, how everything's going to evolve?
I don't know if it's easy, but it's like an engineering challenge. You know, you want to build this house, and in order to put the roof on, you got to get a good foundation, and then something's got to hold up the second floor from the first floor, and then you run the wiring, and sooner or later you got this structure. And for me, I mean, that actually made sense to me relative to a book. I don't know if it made any sense to you when I said it, but it's something I have a feel for, I think. And I don't think a lot about it, quite honestly.
It just seems to come natural to you.
Yeah, I sit down and I know I want to tell the story, and then I know what the scene is going to be. And in fact, when I'm in the zone, the reality of the scene I'm imagining is far more real to me than the reality of the chair and the computer. I've never been an actor, but it's what I think method acting is like. And you sort of assume these characters, and then you behave as you think they would.
Right. And speaking of acting, these are going to be movies. Did I read that one of them is going to be filmed as a movie?
Well, no. I've sold the movie rights to four of my books, and none of the movies has yet to be made. Although it looks like 6 Minutes to Freedom might actually. Take the big step forward. I'm signed on as the screenwriter for that. And
really? Does that mean it will be made at some point? I mean, obviously you're going to write it, but does that mean it will actually get filmed?
No. You can never say a movie is going to be filmed until it's actually finished filming. There are so many moving parts to the movie industry. At least two of the books, Nathan's Run and At All Costs, the first two, were going to be the next vehicle for a major movie star. And, of course, neither one of them has been made. So it's Hollywood is a capricious place.
But they did buy the rights to them, though.
They did indeed, and the check cleared. So,
which is a good thing for you.
That's one important step.
I mean, it's, and you never know. I mean, this kind of a book, I mean, you look at the Bourne movies, they've made billions of dollars. So, I mean, he's not really what I would call a spy, but there's definitely similarities.
But remember, the original Jason Bourne was a Vietnam vet. From that book, the Bourne Identity, was that the first one? Was 20 years old before Matt Damon starred in the character. So.
And now he's moved on to something else. So I mean, which is a little disappointing for me. I don't like when they change the actor in midstream like that.
Oh, I hadn't heard they're doing that. He's not doing the.
Yeah, it's going to be Jeremy Renner now.
Oh, okay.
Which is an interesting choice.
It is.
I like Jeremy Renner. I don't know if I'll like him as much as I like Matt Damon. And there's something about Matt Damon, I think, that this just, I don't know. There's just something. Why do we like one actor over another? I don't know. It's just the appeal, I guess. But I mean.
Well, he brought an intensity and complexity to that character that I've never seen the script, so maybe it was all in the script, but he just seemed to embody that character very well.
But the great thing about the Bourne movies is they're just fun movies. I mean, maybe they're not the best acted movies you'll ever watch, but they're fun to watch from beginning to end. It's just one adventure after another. That's what your books are, too, and it's just the adventure of it. I mean, when you think of adventure, you think of, like, Indiana Jones and the first Raiders of the Lost Ark movie. What a fun movie. And then, like, your books laced with humor. I mean, what's so good about Jonathan Grave is his the way he plays off with his other character. He calls him the big
boxers.
Boxers, but he calls him the big guy or something.
Big guy. That's his radio name. Yeah.
And that's another point. They keep changing names. Do they change names every book? No, I haven't read the other three yet.
No, Jonathan is always Scorpion, and Boxers is always Big Guy, and Vinice is always Mother Hen.
But they do have new identities sometimes in the other books.
No, they're fake identities.
Fake identities, okay.
Have remained constant, but they're going to have to change because of events that happen in Damage Control. They will have different alter egos in the next book.
Now, this is book four. Now, in your mind, are each of the four books different, or are they similarly plotted?
No, they're entirely different, actually. In Hostage Zero, for example, the second book in the series, we learn that Jonathan runs a home for the children of incarcerated parents. It's called Resurrection House, and it's there in Fisherman's Cove, his hometown. And some bad guys come and kidnap two children from Resurrection House. And so Jonathan's motivation in going to get them is entirely different than the motivation in doing other things, and this takes us to the cocaine fields of Colombia so I guess there's a similarity in terms of it's always about the freelance hostage rescue stuff, but it's never about a negotiator on the radio talking to hostage takers. That I find that, first of all, it's been done 1,000 times, and that doesn't engage me.
Well, just reading Damage Control. I haven't read the other three yet, but I mean, I like the way the story unfolds. I like the fact that it doesn't feel like a standard thriller. It feels different. I mean, the humor between the three guys is really interesting. And then you have these other characters some of them are mean, and there's the one guy has mistresses, a whole bunch of different mistresses. And there's so many different characters, and you get to see what each one is like. And I like the way you go between the characters. Each chapter is a different character, and we get to see what they're doing. And then we get to see what this person's doing. And you leave the one character right in the middle of a really dangerous situation, and we go on and we see another character. And then we can come back and see how that person gets out of that. I like that. Well, I like the way that's done.
Thank you.
I mean, I read a lot of books, after a while, if you don't enjoy the story, it can become very old, and you never want to get to the point where you're lumbering through books. You know, you want to enjoy the way it's written.
Well, and I think you want to enjoy the character's adventure. You know, what's happening to these folks.
And you ultimately know where Jonathan's headed? I mean, are there things about Jonathan we're going to find out in later books?
Yes, as a matter of fact, I'm negotiating now. I've started. I might as well say it to do short works, like novella length works between the novels that will reveal some of Jonathan's backstory and Irene Rivers, the director of the FBI, some of her backstory. And
well, how old is Jonathan from book one now to book four? How much of a gap are we talking?
You know what? That's actually classified information. In fact, if you look at my books, there's never a time that he's been described.
So we don't even know how, and why is that?
I know how old he is, but here's what I have found, that I have a lot of fans at a lot of different age groups, and a lot of my younger fans think of him as a really young guy, probably younger than would be possible if you understand what's necessary to become a Delta operator and then retire from it.
Mm-hmm.
And then the older fans kind of have a more reasonable idea, but I don't want to be on the record saying how old I think Jonathan is.
How interesting. I didn't think you'd say that. It's funny, I'm like a lawyer, I don't always know the answer to the question, but that makes it fun, too. I mean, I never know what the author's going to say to me. So that's interesting. I mean, in my mind, he's in his 30s.
Okay.
But that's only in my mind. Of course, what do I know? I'm not a writer, so.
Well, and you know, once the story is on the page, I think the author's opinion means less than the reader's opinion. Because, you know, I've done my job. I've put everything I can put into the book, and after that, it's all the perception of the other people. So.
What about his sidekick? Do we know his age?
Probably about the same age as Jonathan.
Well, you're being very evasive today. Now everybody's going to scramble through the books. I'm going to figure out how old.
Yeah, I got to figure it out.
There's got to be something that tells me how old this guy is. That's so interesting. I mean, I don't even know. If you asked Lee Child how old Jack Reacher was, I guess he'd be able to tell you. But I don't even know myself. I mean. Maybe you don't want. I mean, do you want to think of a 70-year-old man running around doing this stuff?
Well, yeah, and there's also the fact, you know, that if good fortune befalls me and this series becomes a 10, 15, 20 book series, who knows? Certainly, he's not going to age a year for every year of the series, and I don't even think it's necessary that the stories I tell be told in the order that they occur in Jonathan's life. It depends on what, you know, the ancillary actions are. So.
No, but the damage control, how much time takes place between the beginning of the book and the end of the book? Do you know that? Is the reader supposed to know that?
Yeah, I could figure it out. It's been a while since I wrote it. A couple of days, I think. Or is it one day?
Really? Only one day?
See, I think there's one night. It's 2 days. 2 days, one night, I believe.
That's amazing, because when you're reading the book, you don't even think about the time element. I mean, when they mention it, it goes through your head, but you never really think in the long run of how long the book is taking to write. I mean, taking to play out is what I mean to say. Taking you to write, and it takes you, 9 months to write a book?
Oops, you there?
No, I'm here.
Oh,
I'm here.
Okay.
It's just, there's a beep.
I got a big beep.
Okay. Yeah. But does it take you 9 months to write a book, or do you write them faster than that?
I owe a book a year, but the actual writing time, I take a couple months off after, between books, and, so I guess about 9 or 10 months.
Is that a relief, after you're done and you're...
Oh, God, yes. Absolutely. Absolutely.
You get that little two-month gap, and, wow, I don't have to do anything for 2 months.
Well, it's a great sense of accomplishment when you finally go through the book and you finish with the edits, my edits, before I ship it off to my editor, and you realize, wow, okay, I did it. This is the story I wanted to tell. I'm done. Time to have a martini.
But now, in that intervening 2 months, is that when you're thinking about the next story? Or are you already thinking about that?
I'm already thinking about the next story. In fact, at that 220-page mark I was telling you about, there's nothing more fascinating than the next book you're going to write. that one's all fresh. It's got to, you know, you get to write a new beginning. So typically that's what, I'll get about the 50% mark in a book, and then I'll start thinking about the next one and doing the outline.
Now, when do these little novellas start happening? I mean, are you already writing them?
They're pretty much done in my head. I haven't put them on paper yet. And like I said, there's some negotiation between here and there. They're not a sure thing. I probably shouldn't have mentioned them, but...
Oops.
That's
how too many people. I'm really putting my foot in it today, aren't you? The age.
Oh, no. I'm the one who brought it up, so.
But it's true. But I asked the questions to enable you to bring it up. But even in the mass markets, we're going to find out things about Jonathan. Every book, will we find out something new?
Oh, sure. Yeah, Jonathan's character evolves with every book, as does the Nietzsche's character changes. Father Dom, who's a priest friend of Jonathan's.
I love the fact that somebody says right in the middle of the book, "Are you sure you're really a priest? You're not acting like a priest." It's like we all have this preconceived notion of what a priest is going to act like, and they all have to act the same way. You know, we forget they're different. They're people too.
And very loyal. That's one of the things I love about Jonathan's character. Is he inspires, well, first of all, he is intensely loyal himself, and he inspires that loyalty among his close friends.
And he doesn't have any women, you know, that he doesn't seem to have any, I don't know about book 1-3, did he have a girlfriend at all?
Yes. In fact, Gail Bonneville, who...
Oh, I hadn't realized that. Oh,
yeah, they were an item... She was introduced in the first book. They became a real item in Threat Warning, which is named Best Book of 2011 by Suspense Magazine.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Wow, that's a great magazine. I wish they still had that on the newsstand. I miss it already.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's a little aside. But I hadn't realized she was his girlfriend. Ah. But he doesn't seem very focused on women.
He's really busy. that's the question comes up periodically about, you know, why is... You know, there's no romance in the books. It's like, where would I put it? You know,
for romance. When is
I mean, you got this big shootout, and
he's never home.
Well, except when he is. He's never home on the page. I could have a book of him, you know, sitting at home watching football, but yeah, it's kind of.
People would probably not find it very interesting.
That would be a whole different kind of book.
Not enough to stain the whole book. It's interesting though that at least he has time for love. You've got people that you create that become obsessed with certain things. I mean, are you obsessive yourself in real life? I mean, do you have things that you really like to do besides writing?
Yes, I'm sort of, as my son says, I'm CDO, which is OCD in alphabetical order, as it should be. I tend to, once I get interested in something, I kind of glom onto it and become obsessive about it. I enjoy skiing in the wintertime. I like hanging out with people. I like... traveling a lot. My wife and I just got back from Ireland a couple of weeks ago.
Wow.
Just kind of traveled around and met folks. It was...
That sounds like fun.
It was great fun. Yeah, if you get a chance to go, that's... Killarney is one terrific town.
How long were you there?
11 days, I think.
11 days. Do you write when you're on vacation?
I always have stuff with me to write, where my normal output will be... 1,000 to 1,500 words a day, I might get, you know, 150, 200 words down.
Now, will we see a book set in Ireland anytime soon?
You will, actually, in High Treason, which is the book I'm writing right now, I think that you're going to see...
That's book 5?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's book 5. And I believe you're going to see a setting that I found in Ireland, but it won't be in Ireland.
It's funny, you never stop thinking about what you're going to put in your books when you're traveling around. I mean, as a writer, you must constantly, maybe I'll set a book here, or maybe I'll do this, or write what you know. You know, when you're visiting the country, you might as well take advantage of and put it in the book.
Well, sometimes you just walk into a place and you think, wow, this is either, it's so impressive, it's so pretty, it's so scary, it's so imposing, and then you start looking at it and observing people, and so it's always there. I don't think it's active. I don't think I have this active sonar thing going that's always trying to gather information, but it's always out there.
Now, the name of the Reverend Jackie Mitchell, thankfully it's in the first sentence, I'd forgotten her name, but is she modeled after anybody real? I mean, when you model, she's the head of the church, but is she modeled after anybody that you've heard about?
No, she's purely fictitious.
I mean, do you ever see and do you ever read about real people and think, oh, I've got to make that person a character in one of my books and make them really nasty and make them a villain? Do you ever do that?
I meet a few of those. again, it's not one of those active things. I think that the Jackie Mitchell runs the Crystal Palace Cathedral, which is essentially a television church, television evangelism thing. And I think my disdain for those kinds of structures, not disdain of the churches themselves, but how easy it is to lose sight of what churches are supposed to be about, and see them become about money, and that informs a lot of what happens in the book. So, to the degree that I think there are charlatan preachers out there as well as the really good ones, but I can't say you can't overlay one particular ministry over Jackie's, because I don't think anybody is as corrupt as hers is.
Now, are we going to see a book a year from you? Is that the idea? Every year?
Certainly for the next 2 years, and then hopefully after that, yeah. I negotiate 2 book contracts, so.
Do you ever worry that you're not going to be published anymore? I mean, does that ever go through your head? You've been doing it for 15 years. You obviously know what you're doing. I mean, do you ever worry that your fan base won't be there?
I mean, no. I never worry that the fan base isn't going to be there. I worry that the industry is going to change to the point where it's going to be all vampires all the time,
I think we get sick of vampires after a while. I mean, I'm already...
We get sick of all the trends. We got sick of the Da Vinci Code stuff, too. And so what I tell myself is that there will always be room for exciting stories that deal with people that readers want to hang out with.
I don't want to see. I mean, when you have a book like The Da Vinci Code, which was so successful, and then he writes another book, the recent one, The Lost Symbol, which to me is just another reboot of The Da Vinci Code. I don't like that. I want every book to be distinctive. I mean, am I wrong to feel that way? I'm sure you feel that way, too.
I think that's exactly the way I feel. And at one level, I don't know Dan Brown. I've never met Dan Brown.
Neither have I.
But I can't imagine... he was slogging along with moderate success, and then the Da Vinci Code hit, and it became this worldwide phenomenon, and I think it would be extraordinarily difficult to write another book after that.
Absolutely, and especially one that's so totally different. I mean, I like the writing style. I want to see different things each time. I don't want to see the same book done. I mean, in my mind, a lot of it's similar, and I mean, the characters don't much grow, but anyway, I mean, that's just the way I feel, but...
I really admire J.K. Rowling for coming out. In September, she's got her new book coming out, and it's not a kid's book. It's a mystery.
Right.
I think that's the way to do it. You have this enormous success, in her case with Harry Potter, obviously, and you just try something completely different.
I mean, and it must be hard because people want to see Harry Potter again, obviously.
Sure.
Nobody wants to think Harry Potter's gone for good. I mean, the real fans, anyway. And then the excitement of when those books came out was just a wonderful feeling, I mean, for everybody. But at the same time, let's see what else she can do. Let's see how good of a writer she really is. Give her a test. Have her let her do something completely different, what she's doing. And I agree with you. It's very exciting to think about. That's what makes the publishing world so exciting. And what's coming out next? What's going to be the hot book next? I mean, The Help, when I read The Help, my God, it was just an unbelievable book. And, coming from a first writer, it was just amazing. But do you go to ITW still, the thriller
club? Oh, yeah, every year. In fact, I'm nominated for the Thriller Award, the Threat Warning is.
Oh, that's wonderful.
So.
Who are you up against?
I should be able to name this off the top of my head, but I can't. I don't.
Probably all friends of yours.
They're certainly all acquaintances of mine. I don't know. I'm not pulling up any of the names right now.
But and that's the point. When you and being a writer and you go into these conventions, you meet all these people. You make friends. Do you make more acquaintances than friends? I mean, how is the writing community that close where you make friends with a lot of writers?
Well, I think the division for me, friend is a very high standard. And I certainly have made a number of them over
David
the years.
David Baldacci, maybe?
Well, certainly Jeffrey Deaver's a really good friend of mine.
He's Robert now a Gray. Singer, too.
I'm sorry? That's right. He's a songwriter. I don't think he's a singer.
Oh, I thought he sang it, too.
I could be wrong, but I think he wrote them and had them recorded for his...
I thought the sales rep had told me that he actually sung one of the songs. Maybe he did.
Maybe he's holding out on me.
Because I remember thinking, I can't wait to hear what his voice sounds like. Anyway. But you've made some friends over the years, and you meet so many different people. And that's a thrill for the readers to meet the authors. I mean, for me, I love meeting new authors. And for you, you know, you meet so many. I guess, while it's fun, it's business, too.
Well, you know, meeting other writers is not necessarily a business transaction. I enjoy hanging out with writers in the bar. And by the way, let me say, anybody who's listening to this and you go to a conference, hang out in the bar. You don't have to drink. Hang out in the bar and sit down and talk with folks. You know, come up. People are there to be seen and to talk to others. But I have to say, when I sit down with other writers and have a discussion, it's rarely about the industry. It's about everything else that people talk about when, you know, you get together with friends and you talk about stuff.
Right. That's interesting. But, I mean, going to these conventions really helps the sales of your books, obviously.
I think so.
I mean, it gets your name out there.
Anything that raises the profile of an author helps. And I think that readers, it's the nature of books and reading, that it's a very intense relationship between the artist and the recipient of, or I don't know what that is, the observer, the reader. I think you learn, if you read an author's body of work, you come to learn a lot about the author.
And it's interesting. I mean, to be able to tell an author right to their face how much you enjoy their books, that's such a pleasure to do that. I mean, when you know the authors work so hard on these books, you know, I mean, authors just slave away. And then a lot of times it's a very lonely existence. I mean, unless they have a family and children and whatnot. But it's still, writing is a very, you're by yourself.
Well, yeah. Well, and you're playing with your imaginary friends.
Exactly.
They call it psychosis if you do anything else for a living.
Right. That's interesting. Everybody has a different take on writing, and that's certainly one of the more interesting ones. But I think you're probably right when it all boils down to that at some point. But now, when will you finish the next book?
Or before September 15th, because that's my deadline. I'm actually moving along on it pretty quickly. I hope to have it done in August, but we'll see.
Wow. That's great, and then it'll be out next year. I can't wait to read it.
Yeah, come out next June.
I'm kind of addicted to this series now. Just thinking about all the three that I missed now, it's bothering me. I hate when I do that, but I mean, I couldn't possibly read four. You know, it's kind of hard for me to read them fast enough. There's so many authors I have to interview, so I have to limit it. But I'm definitely enjoying this book. I'm definitely going to finish it this weekend. It's been such a pleasure to talk to you.
It's been great.
It's nice to hear from you again after so many years. And the book, again, is called Damage Control. It's available in mass market, $9.99, and all e-book versions you can get on Kindle, I'm sure, and all the different things.
Right.
It's been great to talk to you, John Gilstrap.
It's been a real pleasure. Hope we do it more often.
And this has been David's Book Talk. We'll talk to you next time.